David Hanscom. I'm an orthopedic spine surgeon. I just quit my clinical practice in surgery to pursue this process of trying to slow down the aggressive tide of spine surgery. And my new book is, Do You Really Need Spine Surgery?
Dr. Hanscom, we've spoken a few times before, and you are a spine surgeon, but you have news. You're out of your practice now? Why?
What happened in the last 5 years particularly, spine surgery become so aggressive that I saw 3 to 5 patients every week having surgeries basically on normal spines. And I would estimate probably at least 70% of spine surgery should not be done. And one operation we do, which is a fusion for back pain, has no data. There's not one research paper that documents that it works. But we're probably over $10 to $20 billion a year in spine surgery on an operation that's been documented to be ineffective.
Now, what did you say again? What percentage aren't needed?
Probably at least 70%.
Wow. Wow.
And then the other thing is there's no comparison of surgery to good non-operative care. So our non-operative care became so good, I wrote a book called Back in Control, mm-hmm. A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. With that process, we watched hundreds of patients go pain-free, basically with minimal risk, essentially no cost. I was watching people go to pain-free with minimal risk, having horrendous outcomes on operations on normal spines, and people just don't understand how bad it can be if you have an operation that fails. Then nobody wants to take care of you, and you're really just cast on the scrap heap.
Before we get back to the subject of this current book, you have long advocated expressive writing to deal
right.
with pain. And I have to tell you, I found that to be one of the most helpful things that I have heard about in my 20 years of doing this health and well-being series.
Oh, good.
But here's the thing. I have to ask myself why so many people, they're intelligent people, they're supposedly in the know. Many people who are in pain, they are reluctant to even try anything that's a little outside the box. Why is that? Why won't they try it?
By far and away, the biggest obstacle to healing is willingness to engage. What happens when you're trapped by pain, you become angry.
Yeah.
And as you know, when you're angry and you stay angry, Dr. Sarno in New York called it rage, and it's understandable, you don't necessarily have the same reasoning powers that you do when you're calm. And so people become so angry, it's actually part of the disease that keeps people in the trap, and that's the number one factor in people healing is simply willingness to engage.
Oh.
And I don't know how to break through that, to be honest with you. So my whole goal is, look, here's the book, here's the website, and if people engage, they get better. Probably 90% of the time, usually within 3 to 6 months, but people are so used to being in pain that they don't know another life anymore. And then change is threatening, of course, but willingness to engage is a huge, huge obstacle. It is the obstacle.
Could maybe loved ones play a bigger role, perhaps, in getting them to engage?
Well, that's what's happened since I talked to you last, is that we found out the family is actually the biggest triggers.
Oh.
In other words, when you go... Every family triggered each other, which means they upset each other. And the deeper the relationships, the deeper the triggers, especially in chronic pain. What we found out with the family dynamics, it is the biggest factor keeping people in pain, because people go home and people are angry when they're in pain. They take it out on their family reacts back. And then when you're upset, when your body's chemistry is off with stress chemicals, it doubles the nerve conduction and you hurt even more and you're even more trapped. We found out that the family dynamics are one of the strongest factors keeping people in pain. But also, we wrote a whole section on the website creating some structure on the family dynamics and pain. And within 2 to 4 weeks, once people jump into that structure, things change dramatically for the positive. So by jumping into the family dynamics early, not counseling, by the way, just arbitrary rules to simply break it up, stop. One of the rules we've also developed is never discuss your pain, ever.
I remember you saying that. So don't talk. After leaving the doctor's office, do not talk about it ever again.
Ever.
Hard to do, but worth a try.
Or complaining. We also since found out that the mental pain in the form of anxiety is a bigger problem than the physical pain. And humans have consciousness that can't escape their thoughts. Unpleasant thoughts create the same pain reaction in the body, chemical reaction, as physical pain does. Turns out that mental pain is a much bigger problem than physical pain because what happens, it changes your body's chemistry. increases your stress chemicals, then each organ is affected. There's over 30 symptoms of a stressed nervous system, with one of them being increased chance of autoimmune disorders, because it changes the inflammatory response.
Backtracking then, Dr. Hanscom, can surgery, people I guess are sort of programmed in America to think, hey, you know what, I'll just have an operation, it'll cure everything. But can surgery stop chronic pain? Science says no.
It does say no. And there's a paper came out last month in the Journal of Pain that documented that essentially every procedure that we do does not work in chronic pain anywhere. Knees, hips, any part of the body. If somebody has chronic pain, what happens is it gets memorized. It's similar to phantom limb pain, where it's pretty dramatic to have a leg amputated and a person still feels the leg, and they feel the pain just like the leg was still there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's pretty unbelievable if you think about it. And people have to understand that pain is a interpretation of sensory input. All it says is danger. In other words, every second your brain is processing about 11 million bits of information per second. Your conscious brain is processing 40. It's 11 million to 40 ratio. And so your brain's taking all the sensory input in. It totals it up every second and says safe, dangerous, or pleasant. We survive by avoiding danger and then gravitate towards pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, the body keeps us automatically in a range of neutral, so we don't feel pleasure or pain. And when you feel pain, actually, by the way, you simply exceeded the threshold. Pain is a result of sensory input. It's not generated by the... In other words, just, if there's a bone spur, the bone spur is not generating the pain. The signal goes to the brain, and then the brain interprets that signal.
So what should a person ask to determine if they truly need a procedure?
I'm not against surgery, but the data clearly says that you have to prepare yourself. If you were my patient, what I would do, I'd say, look, are you sleeping? What's your stress levels like? Let's adjust your medication. Let's exercise. What we did was called rehab before surgery, for about 12 weeks before every surgery we did. We had over 100 patients with surgical lesions. In other words, big bone spurs and leg pain canceled the surgeries because the leg pain disappeared.
Wow.
I basically put myself out of business. And the data says if you operate in the presence of untreated chronic pain, you can make it worse 40 to 60% of the time. That's very clear data. There's, again, the elephant in the room, there's no data on expressive writing. I'm sorry, there's 1,000 papers on expressive writing. Mm-hmm. I was never taught that at any point in my training. There's no research. There's not one paper that documents that a fusion for back pain works, and disc degeneration, which is the most common reason to have a fusion, has been documented to be not a source of pain. So we're doing billions of dollars of surgery on a structure that's been documented to be not a source of pain.
And you also say that surgeries are contributing to the opioid crisis.
Absolutely. I mean, if you have a normal spine, and you can calm down the nervous system, change the body's chemistry, and go to pain-free, that's wonderful, and people thrive. Conversely, if you do an operation on a normal spine, you make the nervous system worse, It hurts. People get disabled. They become very disabled. So it costs $100,000 for a fusion by timing it up all the cost. Then people end up with multiple surgeries, increased pain, and they become disabled. Again, we have hundreds of patients going to pain-free with essentially no interventions. And again, we weren't taught this in medical school. So again, 1,000 papers, for instance, now there's a book out that documents this, that the research was done in the 80s, expressive writing works. We were never taught that.
You talk about performing surgery on anxiety.
Well, again, you know, it's like phantom limb pain in any part of the body. It doesn't matter what you do. In other words, it doesn't matter where the pain starts. We know it gets memorized in about 6 to 12 months. Then it doesn't matter. I mean, any part of the body that you do the procedure on, it's not going to work because, again, it's like phantom limb pain.
Yeah.
So then, of course, that phantom limb pain creates tremendous frustration and anxiety. Instead of calming down the nervous system and calming down the body's chemistry, we're doing a procedure of something that doesn't exist. Or if it exists, then it's already memorized. But what the book does, it lays down, first of all, is it possible to do the surgery? Again, doing surgery on a normal spine is not going to work. It looks at the state of the nervous system. Are you calm or stressed? It creates a quadrant of four boxes that allows you to accurately make a really good surgical decision.
Do your fellow spine surgeons dislike you, or are they perhaps coming to your way of thinking? And what do you intend to do now as far as your practice is concerned?
Well, I stopped doing surgery in December. Mm-hmm. I just finished this book. It's going to be out next week on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and in the bookstores. And I train my fellows like this. I've trained probably 25 fellows like this. And they do go out with this mindset. But most places are going just for volume. They're not really talking to the patients. They're not finding out the issues. And they're just jumping in and doing surgery literally on the first visit. Mm-hmm. And one of my pieces of advice to patients, if a surgeon tells you on the first visit to perform surgery, just get out of there. It's not correct. They don't know who you are. You're not prepped. They're not following the data. And that happens a lot. Probably 40% of the surgeons in the country are asking patients to get imaging first. They walk in the room saying yes or no, do you need surgery or not? And by the way, the chiropractors, massage therapists, acupuncturists, osteopaths are way ahead of medicine right now on this process. I mean, there's a whole neuroscience literature out there that's extremely deep on this. This is not light data. And so there's many practitioners right now that are actually on top of this data, making excellent decisions, and the surgeons are not part of that group right now. Now, I think they will be once it gets out into their consciousness, but right now we're just going very quickly down the surgical route with no data.
Will you set up your practice again somewhere else in a totally different approach?
Well, what I'm doing, I'm going around the country setting up consulting, working with different companies to actually put these processes into their system.
Excellent.
Now, my goal is much bigger than that. I mean, I really want to get this message out in the public domain. Right now, you're taught that surgery is going to fix you. My message, it is not. You can fix yourself. If you were watching my patients suffer like I've been watching, I mean, I walked into a room a few years ago, and there's this young kid who did not need surgery, paralyzed.
Oh, man.
That was it. I said, I'm done. But I saw stuff like that 3 to 5 times every week. This is not uncommon. And it's really unbelievable right now.
And unconscionable.
I think so. I right now, I think a big part of our healthcare crisis, in fact, we had a big conference. I gave 2 talks this weekend, one in Seattle and one in Las Vegas. And I just begged the group, look, the number one thing that would change medicine is actually simply change the fee schedule for doctors to talk to their patients. We don't know who you are. And I've actually gotten penalized for talking to my patients. I have friends of mine have been fired for talking to their patients. And you can't solve a problem unless you know the variables. And we're not only time to talk to our patients, we're actually penalized for it all over the country. And so the number one thing that would change medicine dramatically is actually changing to allow doctors to talk to their patients.
Well, I love talking to you, and I always learn so much. And thank you so much for writing the book and, of course, for taking the time to talk to me about it today. And
thank
best
you.
Of luck
Thank
for
allowing
you.
Me to share my views. I appreciate that very much.